about the men of the church. Give us men. Men from every rank, fresh and free and frank. Men of thought and reading. Men of light and leading. Men of loyal breeding, the nation's welfare speeding. Men of faith and not of faction. Men of lofty aim and action. Give us men, I say again, give us men. Give us men, strong and stalwart ones, men whom highest hope inspires, men whom purest honor fires, men who trample self beneath them, men who make their country wreath them as her noble sons, worthy of their sires, men who never shame their mothers, men who never fail their brothers. True, however false, are others. Give us men. I say again, give us men. Give us men, men who, when the tempest gathers, grasp the standard of their fathers in the thickest fight, men who strike for home and altar, let the coward cringe and falter. God defend the right. True as truth, though lorn and lonely, tender as the brave are only. Men who treat where saints have trod, men for country, home, and God. Give us men. I say again, give us men. God purposed the church. He planned it, predicted it, purchased it, and planted it, and he established the authority within the church. Jesus is the head of the church, Ephesians 1:22, Colossians 1:18. He has been granted all authority over the Lord's universal church. But God also ordained a local, congregational, human leadership for the church as well. God ordained a human leadership to implement those things that God has legislated and to deal with things that God has not specifically regulated in the purview of his people. There are four different possible categories of organizations that congregations fall into. A congregation can be scripturally organized, and this is the Lord's desire. It's our desire as well that a congregation be scripturally organized. There is a temporary organization for the church. Paul said to Titus in Titus 1:5, "For this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou might set in order the things that are wanting or lacking, and ordain elders in every city as I had appointed thee." There is that temporary leadership until an evangelist can successfully work himself out of the job of that leadership and appoint a more permanent government. There is the more permanent government. We see this in the first chapter of the Philippian letter, where we have the bishops and deacons mentioned there. God has placed governments in the church, 1 Corinthians 12:28, perhaps referring to the temporary and the permanent governments in the church. By government, we mean a steering or a piloting or a directing of the church. It's possible for a congregation to be scripturally unorganized, if that's the best that that congregation can do. And sometimes it is. This is by necessity. When your congregation is scripturally unorganized, it means you cannot have either one of the kinds of leadership that we've mentioned already. For whatever reasons, then you just do the best you can until you can do better than that. It's possible for a congregation to be unscripturally organized. When a congregation is unscripturally organized, sometimes this means that they have added on an office that's not found for the church in the New Testament. It would be something that's not according to the pattern that we find given to us in the Scriptures. And finally, it's possible for a congregation to be unscripturally unorganized if they should and could have officers, but for some reason they choose not to. That would be an unscriptural unorganization of that congregation. You come from a congregation, surely, that fits into one of these four categories. You know of other congregations that fit into various categories. I've been assigned to talk about the leadership of the congregation and the training for elders and deacons in particular, although I was told that this could include evangelists as well. Training for elders and deacons, training the trainers, and now is the time to serve. Let's talk first about the necessity of strong scriptural leadership. The Bible talks about a plurality of elders within a congregation. The elders was in the plural in Titus 1:5, which I mentioned. Also in Acts 14:23, Paul and Barnabas appointed elders in every city where they could do so. I do not believe that if a man's partners in the eldership pass on and he is left alone there, that he needs to necessarily resign from that office. And I don't believe that's necessary for a number of reasons that we can discuss if you want to. If you don't want to, I may not go back to that point. The Holy Spirit made them overseers, and I believe they stay in to do the best that they can, or it's legitimate for them to stay in as a one-man eldership and make that as temporary as possible until it's possible to get somebody else in that office with him. I don't see going back to an evangelist as being a better thing than that. But the Bible, when it's dealing with the ideal, it talks about the plurality of elders in the congregation. I would not appoint just one man to be an elder over a congregation. We would always appoint a plurality. And leadership is extremely important. John was talking about that a river will not rise above its source, and that's true in a congregation. It will not rise above its leadership. There's a tremendous necessity for strong scriptural leadership in the church. As elders, we are caretakers of the flock of God, Acts 20:28. The flock of God needs to be fed by us. 1 Timothy, 1 Peter, as you know, they all deal with this. Elders are caretakers of the truth. The church is the pillar and the support, pillar and ground of the truth, 1 Timothy 3:15. Elders lead the church in defending, upholding, supporting the truth. Titus chapter 1, 9 through 11, Acts 20:29. I'm assuming you're well familiar with these scriptures. Elders are caretakers of the souls within the congregation, Hebrews 13:17, Matthew 18:12 through 14. This can get an elder resented, but we ought not to be in the habit of resenting godly shepherds. Elders are caretakers of the purity of the Lord's bride, because 1 Corinthians 5, a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. Jesus went to great lengths to make the church holy. Ephesians 5 teaches that. And we ought to go to great lengths to keep the Lord's church holy. 2 Corinthians 11:2. Elders are to take the lead in these matters without being afraid of being sued by somebody. Elders are also caretakers of their own selves. Acts 20:28. Take heed unto yourselves. This means living like you ought to, showing the way to heaven by example. They are ensamples, examples to the flock, in both their public participation and in their personal decisions. So, what are the characteristics of strong scriptural leadership? What does it look like? If we are going to talk about getting there, we need to see what the goal is, maybe first of all. I'm going to place some things on the board that I think are very important for strong scriptural leaders to be. The first thing is Christ-like. This man needs to have read the New Testament scriptures repeatedly. He needs to, as much as he possibly can, make his life like the life of Christ. And that means to be spiritually minded. In the sixth chapter of the book of John, we see the spiritual contrasted with the physical. Many who weren't getting what they wanted physically went away and didn't follow the Lord anymore. He talked in spiritual terms. In John 4, he talked about living water, a spiritual concept. In John 14, he talked about peace from a spiritual point of view, not a physical point of view. In John 18, he said, "My kingdom is not of this world." Jesus was spiritually minded when he was still a boy. "Wished ye not that I must be about my Father's business?" We're told, each of us, let this mind be in you, which also was in Christ Jesus. Men who are non-spiritual cannot do this spiritual work. The mind of Christ was an obedient, serving mind. He came to serve and not to be served, and he lived on a spiritual plane. So this is the first thing, to be as Christ-like as we possibly can. Also, and included in that, is the idea of courage. A strong scriptural leader is courageous. Courage is one of the Christian graces in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 5. We're talking here about virtue, moral excellence, firmly planted on the foundation of faith. When we read the 11th chapter of Hebrews, the faith chapter, every one of those people demonstrated courage. They did it on the basis of faith, but their courage was exemplary. Each one exhibited that because of their faith. You can go right down the line. Abel, Noah, Abraham, clear down through Peter and Paul. They all exhibited courage. And faith is the basis of spiritual courage. Christian leaders need courage. They are mere men, and it takes a lot of courage to accept this responsibility. It takes a lot of courage to make a decision for the church, realizing that you could be wrong when you're making this decision. It takes courage for a man to do that which others are unwilling to do. It takes courage to make a decision that you know when you make it, other people are going to criticize. It takes courage to go talk to people about the sin in their life. I don't know any elder who just loves to go do that, who just can't wait for the next opportunity to go talk to somebody about the sin in their life. But yet this is a responsibility that elders have. Anybody that loves doing it probably isn't going to be very good at doing it. There ought to be some reticence there, but yet we need to have the courage to go ahead and do this. What instills this in us? It is the faith that we have in our Lord, and it takes courage to lead the church. A third thing I'll mention is confidence. I don't want to be misunderstood about this. It's not arrogance. It's not high-mindedness. It's not lording it over God's heritage. But it is a confidence that I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. The confidence is not in ourselves. We realize that when we're weak, then we are strong, that the Lord equips us to do everything that he desires us to do. Confidence is important in a leader. It's contagious in the congregation. It can boost a congregation into doing the Lord's will. The thing that instills confidence in leaders is preparation, prayer, and remembering the promise that the Lord made about leaving you alone. I find a great deal of satisfaction from that verse in Philippians 4:15. I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. And he said, lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Another attribute of mature spiritual leadership is that it is compassionate. It is often said of Jesus that he had compassion on people. He saw them as sheep without a shepherd. And that's partly why he provided shepherds for his church, under shepherds, human shepherds for his church, because he is a compassionate Lord. If you are an elder in the church, it's because a compassionate Lord did not want his sheep to be without a shepherd. Elders must have a genuine love for the flock that they oversee. They must show a genuine shepherd's care. And often this means the sacrifice of self. Often it means losing sleep. Often it means giving up activities that you'd perhaps rather be involved in. It's hard to tell when a genuine shepherd's care is going to be required. But when it is required, we must give that. Compassion does not mean overlooking wrong. That's not what we're talking about. It means that as in dealing with children, as John was discussing, we do what needs doing when it needs doing, and we do it out of a loving spirit. We have a relationship with each person in the flock so that whatever we need to do is done within the context of that relationship where we know them and perhaps have won their heart. It means sometimes saying, go thy way and sin no more. When Jesus said that to the woman taken in adultery, he in no way condoned what she had done. He told her not to do it anymore. He told her that he wanted her to behave better in the future than she had in the past. And he loved her in a way that she may never have been loved by a man before. This undoubtedly made a good impression upon her. Real scriptural leadership is compassionate. It is also concerned. Scriptural leadership is concerned. A good elder is concerned with the direction that the congregation is going. It's concerned with the direction that each individual within the congregation is going. A good elder is concerned to know the members of his congregation, know their troubles, their heartaches, their idiosyncrasies. A good shepherd knows something about each of the sheep, knows their personalities, their peculiarities. A good shepherd is concerned to the level of being approachable, making himself available, being willing to listen. A good shepherd is consistent. Consistency, thou art a jewel, somebody said. Somebody said a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. I'm not talking here about a foolish consistency. I'm talking about a realistic consistency that we should all have. We all should be consistent within our Christian lives. But elders, more than anyone, should be consistent in their Christian lives and consistent in their public proclamations, consistent in the decisions that they make for the congregation. You talk about rules being changed, that happens sometimes, and it does leave people feeling insecure, feeling that there is a capriciousness there that needs not to be there. A congregation needs to know what to expect from its leaders. I've been blessed with leaders who are very even-keeled men. They're the same one week as they are the next week. They're the same one month or one year as they are the next. You know what to expect from both the present leaders of this congregation and leaders that we have had in the past here. And it makes a great deal of difference. If you have a leader in a congregation who's always on a roller coaster, you can't tell from one day to the next whether he'll be high or low. That places some consternation within the congregation. They don't know what to expect. They have to see how he's doing today before they will approach him. We need men who are consistent and people know what to expect from them. Also, he needs to be communicative. He needs to be as good a communicator as he possibly can be. Part of this may be natural, may come from the aptitude to teach that must be within him if he is to be placed in this office in the first place. If it did not come naturally to him to be communicative, he needs to learn that. Members of the congregation should have opportunity, for instance, to know what's happening with the money that they perhaps dig down deep into their pockets and give to the congregation. Members of the congregation need to have a say in how that money is being spent. Elders need to inform. Sometimes they need to rebuke. Sometimes they need to exhort. Failure to communicate genders an uncertainty. Sometimes it genders a malcontent. Sometimes it brings about feelings of helplessness and even futility within the congregation if communication is not good. Sometimes good communication, I've seen this in several instances, sometimes good communication can prevent potential problems from becoming actual problems and also help solve some of the problems after they exist. It's amazing what good communication can sometimes do. These men whom we place in the leadership of the congregation must be men of conviction. Politicians stick their finger up in the wind to see which way it's blowing, and then they make their pronouncement. Especially in a democracy, this is true because it's all about the votes. But this is not true of the leaders in the church. When leaders don't have conviction, they're nothing more than followers. Conviction is like confidence. It comes from knowing what the will of the Lord is. It comes from being a workman that needeth not to be ashamed. Without conviction, elders cannot possibly obey Titus 1, 9 through 11, where they convict the gainsayer. They need to have convictions of their own in order to be able to do that. These must be men who are, to some degree, capable men. Now, all men are capable of something, but some men have considerable more capability than other men. Great businessmen do not always make good leaders in the church, because the way the two successes are measured are sometimes diametrically opposite of one another. Profit is not the bottom line in the church. Sometimes in business it may be. These are men who must be good heads of their households. That's a requirement. He ruleth well his own house. They are experienced Christians. None of them are novices. They are respected citizens. They have a good report of those that are without. They are diligent students of the Word of God. They are capable teachers. They have some degree of aptitude there. How much would be enough is a judgment call within the congregation. But they must be capable teachers, whatever that means. These men also, to put one final point on the board, are men who have a tendency to be calm. Not soon angry. Very important in the role of the eldership. Not soon angry. Have a general tendency to be calm. They are swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Getting people to do something in the church because they feel an explosion, or they fear an explosion in the leadership, is not biblical leadership. The congregation needs to have confidence in these men that they can and will lead the congregation with a sense of calmness, with a sense of serenity in what they do. We cultivate scriptural leadership by constant edification. We talk on a regular basis about the work of elders, the need for elders, the qualifications of elders, the authority of elders, our response to elders, the rewards of being an elder for the man and his family and so forth. These things need to be a part of what is regularly said within the congregation. We cultivate scriptural leadership within a congregation by constant encouragement. Constant encouragement. If all your children ever hear from you about the eldership is how they're not doing anything right, if you have fried elder for lunch every Sunday and your children are hearing this, nobody's going to want to grow up to be an elder or an elder's wife. If you ask them to do this work, and by the way, I don't know why they would be an elder if the congregation did not ask them to do this work. If we ask them to do this work, then we need to encourage them in this work. This is a very thankless task, year in and year out. In almost all cases, there's no money changing hand. What is a man's motivation for doing this work? I can't think of much motivation except that he loves the Lord and wants to serve his church. He wants things to go well for the Lord's cause. So we need to encourage them in this. We don't need to agree with everything they do in order to encourage them in their eldership and stand behind them, help them, hold up their hands, support them financially in some cases, if and when that's appropriate, speak well of them to others, if and when we possibly can, and we can usually find something good to say. We need to encourage elders' families as well as the men themselves. There's a lot of sacrifice that goes on the part of elders' wives and in some cases on the part of the children of elders. Support of good elders and proper treatment of their families is likely to help inspire other people to qualify themselves for this vital function. And don't forget, those of us who are older will soon be gone and it will be left to the next generation to do this work. This change is taking place every day. We need to encourage young men to qualify themselves for this function. We need to constantly esteem them. That's Bible. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 12 and 13. Know them which labor among you and are over you in the Lord. And in our day, that is elders, in some cases evangelists, but primarily he's talking here about elders, surely. Know them which labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you and esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. And be at peace among yourselves. You can help them in their work if we will be at peace among ourselves. Hebrews 13:17 addresses this. So, long story short on this, we need men with the courage of Daniel, with the faith of Abraham, with the heart of Jeremiah, the boldness of Paul, the conviction of Stephen, the vision of Joshua and Caleb, the resiliency of Peter, the obedience of Noah, the integrity of Job, and the strength of Samson. That's what we need for the future of the church in its leadership. Leadership, yes, John, please.
We made a statement a moment ago that we should be prepared to offer them financial support if and when.
Yes. Yes.
I was already thinking about it even before you mentioned it. My limited responsibilities at JC can give me a whole new appreciation for what elders must be going through in these large congregations. And, you're right, I'm beginning to appreciate it, like how much time real shepherding takes.
Yes.
At what point does it become appropriate to support elders? Because we really don't do too much of it from what I see.
Yeah.
Should we be doing more of it so that we don't have so many part-time elders?
Well, I don't know if we should be doing more of it, but I think we should be doing more considering of the possibility, perhaps. And this is an internal matter within a congregation. There are a number of things to consider. If you have multiple elders and you can't support them all, then if you support one, is he going to begin to be viewed as a sort of a head elder or bearing more responsibility than the others? There are a lot of things to consider, and maybe in some of your own congregations you have gone through this. The important thing I want to put on the table for us is just to consider this within our congregations and see whether you think it's appropriate. See whether you think that this could be beneficial to the church. There are a million things that elders can and should do that don't get done because of the pressure of time. I knew one congregation about 500 miles from here that for a while, they had three elders, for a while they were supporting an elder every week in turn. And the men fortunately had jobs that could be facilitated by this process. And they would support one elder one week, support the next elder the next week, and the next elder the next week, and then the first one again the fourth week. And they did this on a regular basis for quite some time. And everybody seemed to be, as far as I knew at the time this was going on, pretty pleased with the result. A lot more did get done when time was freed up. So, and that way, every elder was being supported equally. I realize that a lot of elders' jobs wouldn't allow for that. You're either in your job or you're not in your job, and you're not going to be taking a week off every month or every 4 weeks to give your time full time to the church. So that was a kind of a unique situation. But my point is that as an internal matter, that congregation arrived at that conclusion that that would be the thing for them to do, and I think with positive benefits for the congregation. It's perfectly scriptural, as I think we all know from 1 Timothy chapter 5, and that an elder is worthy of double honor, and honor there carrying the weight of finances. He's worthy of financial support if he serves well in word and doctrine. There's some evangelism involved in that too, as well, it would seem to me. That would be the word part, and the doctrine part would be the part for the church. Not everybody sees that last little bit, those last three words, the same way that I do. But however that may be, this is an appropriate thing that we can do in the church and for the church, and it does need to be considered, and perhaps considered occasionally as situations change. It might be better in some cases to support an elder or elders than to use money in some other ways that the congregation is, or it might not be. I don't know. It's an internal choice within the congregation, but it's one thing that ought to be on the table of consideration, I think, and I appreciate you raising that point. Did you want to say any more about that? It's a perfectly appropriate thing to do, and when I look back over the elderly life of some of the brethren who are here, who may not be in the eldership anymore, I know that time was a severe issue. I've ridden to enough officers' meetings with Chad, for example, when he was putting in 20-hour days sometimes at the post office. I remember going home with Chad about midnight one night from an elders' meeting, and he said, "Well, I've had these clothes on since 4 this morning. I'm getting kind of tired of them." And that was not unusual. He put in a lot of long days. How would his eldership have been different if he had been supported by the church on some kind of a basis? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that he would have accepted it. I know years ago this was discussed and was set aside as something that we weren't going to do, and I don't know exactly how we got to that conclusion. Go ahead, Chad. I appreciate that comment because that's really what I'm talking about is alertness. We need to see what our options are. There is a great deal that elders can do. Sometimes elders are not aware of all the things that perhaps need to be done. John?
And sometimes there is talk, you know, that I don't mean this in a personal way at all, I just think it's relevant that evangelists are doing what they ought to be doing or something. The evangelists are engaged in so many internal matters and aren't spreading the gospel so well. If you had elderships that had more time and were able to do all these things and were thinking about doing all these things you're talking about, it may well free up the evangelists not to have their attention drawn to the internal matters, free them up to look more out.
Right. That's very true. If we can see a need for this, I think the money would be there for it. There is a lot of money in the church, a lot of money. We're in the process, for example, of building a meeting house at Lone Jack. We took loans from the church to facilitate that process. There's a lot of money sitting in the church. And when people see a cause that they believe in, they can get very altruistic at times when it comes to shaking loose of some money. If there's a goal that they see would be worthwhile, if people can come to believe that a full-time eldership supported to whatever extent by the church is the thing that the church needs, then I think it'll happen. I don't think it's a financial issue primarily. I think it's maybe an issue of our vision about what the eldership is really intended to be by the Lord. Good. I like that idea about retirees being able to give full time to this, either without support or with a little support. And there are men in the room right now that are already basically doing this, I think, quietly doing it. Not with support, but without support, just going on their pensions and other funds that they have. Appreciate that discussion. Anybody else want to comment on supporting elders? All right. Leadership in the Lord's body results from committed Christian living by the members of the body. We do not know who the elders of the future are going to be, but the wellspring of it will be conviction. The wellspring of it will be faith. We need leadership in the church very badly. But we need to start in the right place to secure that leadership. If every one of us will fully lend ourselves to the Lord's cause, then all of our leadership's needs are going to be abundantly met. We don't have to worry about that. It's when we do not do this that often people look for a substitute or a shortcut or an easier way than the way of the cross. And there is no other way than the way of the cross. John was talking about what goes on in the home, and I think when we talk about the training of elders and deacons, the home is the place where we have to start. That is step one. And I won't maybe say too much about this because John has already covered it to a certain extent, but I think if the training for future elders and deacons starts any later than at birth, it will be a detriment to the young man that we're talking about. Paul said to Timothy, "When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also." He's showing a pattern here. First in the grandmother, then in the mother, and then in the son. The first step in building leaders in the church is taken right when the child's first steps are being taken. I had a mother who stayed home and raised me. I can't imagine how my life might be different now if I had not had such a mother. That was a tremendous benefit to me, an incalculable benefit to me. The influence of a woman on a man is terrifying when you look at how dramatic it is. And this is true in romantic relationships. It's true in marriage. It's true in mother-son relationships. It's just, you cannot overestimate the influence that women have on our lives. The first step in building leaders has to do with that mother. She read me Bible stories years before I could read them for myself. I can still remember the sound of her voice sitting on the couch reading me Bible stories. I had a father who nurtured and admonished me, taught me that wisdom is the principal thing. When I visited my grandparents up in Parkville, we talked about the Bible. When I visited my other grandparents in Bramer, we talked about the Bible. When I went to my aunt and uncle's house, we talked about the Bible. It begins with the faith that's found in the parents and the relatives who are around that child. I think always of Romans 1:16 with regard to this. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, whether Jewish or Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. There's a lot involved in that expression, from faith to faith. But I always think of that when I'm thinking about the development of leadership. You cannot develop faith in a child unless you have that firm foundation of faith within yourself. It's almost absorbed by osmosis from faith to faith. Paul said to Timothy again, I besought thee to abide still at Ephesus when I went into Macedonia, that thou mightest charge some that they teach no other doctrine, neither give heed to fables and endless genealogies which minister questions rather than godly edifying, which is in faith. So do. Godly edifying is in faith. Now, he said the end of the commandment is charity out of a pure heart and of a good conscience and of faith unfeigned. That genuine faith that started in Lois and came through Eunice and came into Timothy. A faith demonstrated by doing, not by pretense or words only. Not only what the parent says, but what the parent lives. That faith is absorbed by osmosis. And I don't think there's any faith that's stronger than the faith that begins at the mother's knee. This is where the building of leaders begins. And if it begins any later than that, I think it's a handicap to that young person. Is it a handicap that can be overcome? Of course it is. Obviously it is. We look around and we see that this can obviously be overcome. We can make up for lost time later. But I'm just saying this is God's ideal, that we start in the home, which is the first step. It's in the home that the boy learns to stand alone, even when that's not popular with his peers. My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. Proverbs 1:10. There's so much in the book of Proverbs about this. Refrain your foot from their path. Walk not in the way with them. The book of Proverbs shows that we will become like those that we spend our time with. It's important to teach our children and remind ourselves of the importance of standing alone when necessary. It's our responsibility to set a standard that is right. It's our responsibility to teach our children that it's best if our best friends are Christian friends. Sometimes our children don't know how to choose friends. They may just go with whoever is attracted to them and let those be their friends. These may be the wrong ones. We need to teach our children what are the qualities that we should look for in a person that we want to call our friend. Teach them what a friend is. Constantly remind yourself and your children of the consequences of wrong. It's easy to believe the masquerade of the devil. And the younger we are, I think the easier it is to believe that masquerade. He always paints such a beautiful picture as he shows you the beginnings of sin, the pleasures of sin for a season, the passing pleasures of sin. Convince yourself and your child that the consequences of sin are worse than the pleasures of sin. I was envious of the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked, the psalmist said, Psalm 73:2-3. This is a real magnet, or can be, to the young eye and the young mind. He sees the popularity of people who are wrong and in sin, and he thinks, boy, that'd be great. This is the way to live. And then later in perspective, he might understand that end after he's messed his life up. Everything looked great on the surface until I saw it from God's perspective, and then I saw the end of it, and I realized it wasn't as good as it had looked at the beginning. I think we should acquaint ourselves and our children with the biographies of men and women, that there may be some points that would be good to emulate. Proverbs 13:20 says, "Those who walk with the wise will be wise." You become like those that you think about and spend your time with, biblical or otherwise. Acquaint them with the biographies of Daniel and Moses and Elijah. Show how to stand alone wisely with the least embarrassment and giving the least amount of offense as a mark of maturity. This is learned in the home primarily. It's in the home that our boys learn to be open to reproof and to counsel. And they in turn learn to teach their children to be. So many biblical examples of this that I'll just skip over. But it's important to deal with attitudes as well as actions. We're talking about hearts here as well as just actions. We're involved in the construction of character from day one or before day one when these babies come into our families. So we need to help our children see the value of the policeman on the street and to see that, yes, he's a man, he's human, he makes mistakes, but here's the purpose that he serves in the community. We need to help them see the value of the teacher in the classroom, help him learn to respect an employer. Tell the child how you have failed to listen to reproof and how you paid for that. Hear counsel and receive instruction that you may be wise in thy latter end, Proverbs 19, verse 20. This is all learned in the home. In the home, we learn how to deal with temptation. This is hit, as you know, very hard in the Proverbs, especially sexual immorality and strong drink. Both of those are hit very hard there. The lips of the strange woman drop as honeycomb. Her mouth is as smooth as oil, Proverbs 5, beginning in verse 1. Do you remind yourself of that? Have you taught your sons that? They need to know that. There are those in the street who will want them and want their bodies, and they will be extremely attractive on the surface. Their lips will drop words like honey. Their approach will be as smooth as oil. Here's what you need to watch out for, son. Have you taught them these things? That her end is bitter as wormwood and sharp as a two-edged sword. The sixth chapter of Proverbs talks about the commandment to keep you from the evil woman. Once again, her words are mentioned there. We are instructed not to picture her beauty in our minds. Learn, teach our sons how to spend our mental energy in the right way. Have we learned to deal with this? If you've learned to deal with it, your son probably has not. He doesn't know how to deal with this type of person, most likely. He doesn't meet her later on when he's out in the world on a business trip. He meets her right now in school. He may meet her next door in the neighborhood. So he needs to know how to respond to her now, when he meets her now. Tell them how to say no when there is every occasion to say yes. And the same issue would be true of strong drink and drugs as well. If a child simply went by what he heard and saw around him, on billboards and ads, he might be led completely down the wrong path of life. So we, as fathers, do this instructing in the home. This is part of training future elders in the church. This is not something that's going to happen later. It's happening right now. A heavy drinker of wine, it may look attractive, but you're going to be in rags, so don't even look at it. He gives the testimony of one who has become hooked on it in Proverbs 23. And the miserable whirlpool that sucks us down. Alcohol is put before us and pressed upon us in life, but it can tear down character quicker than you can build it up. And the writer of Proverbs says it will sting like a snake. So our sons need to hear this from us just in our normal manner of life. I'm not talking about formal teaching sessions, although there's certainly nothing wrong with those. But I'm talking about primarily as we drive down the road with our son, you see a billboard. These things can be mentioned. Those are moments for instruction. It's in the home that a boy needs to learn to handle his finances, learns to invest his money in things that are honoring to God. Honor the Lord with thy substance, Proverbs chapter 3, verse 9 and 10. It's in the home, I think primarily, that he learns about giving and earning and spending and saving. If he has an allowance, do we instruct him what to do with that? Do we advise him about that? Are your children learning how to handle their money? Do they know the value of giving? Do they know the wisdom of saving? Have we shown them what to buy, how to buy not the cheapest thing necessarily, but to buy quality which may take longer to save for, but may last longer in the long run. Have you taken them to the store and shown them why you buy the things that you do and why you don't buy the things that you don't do? Does your own example support the message that you would like to convey about this? Solomon says that the one who borrows constantly becomes a slave to the moneylender. Your family is rare if everybody in it learns how to manage their money well. Also in the family, we learn about working hard. This is where those parameters are set, where many of our work habits are developed. Proverbs 10, verses 4 and 5 talks about this. The idea that hard work pays off. Work is the means that we achieve what we want and avoid what we don't want. That's the Bible message. And if the young person today just listens to all of his buddies about this, he may hear a wrong signal, because some of them are going to say it's only ignorant people that work. If you're smart enough, you can get by without working. And that's never been truer than it is at this present time in our country. God says that all of us should learn the value of hard work. Work habits are extremely important in leaders in the church, because if the leaders in the church are not self-starters, then they're fairly worthless. We need to learn how to stand alone, be open to reproof, deal with temptation and the handling of finances, and working hard. We need to learn all of that at some point. It's best if we learn it in the home. There are little eyes upon us, and they're watching night and day. There are little ears that quickly take in every word you say. There are little hands all eager to do everything you do, and a little boy who's dreaming of the day he'll be like you. Step two, the child comes from the home and comes into the church. Is at some point baptized into Christ and becomes a member of the local congregation. Maybe they're converted from the outside, but at some point they become a member of the local congregation. Here, that young man is given new opportunities to serve and to work and to learn. Here, opportunity and encouragement is given to all of our young men. I think we need to think in terms of each congregation being a training organism. Each congregation is a school. Somebody asked me not too long ago, do you believe in Christian colleges? I said, I believe in the Lord's congregations, and every one of them is supposed to be a Christian college. We would have maybe never thought of the idea of having separate Christian colleges if the Lord's congregations had been everything that they needed to be. It needs to be a training organism, a place of growth. This is one of the great purposes of the church, a place where growth is expected, where growth is exemplified, and where growth is encouraged. Not just keeping house for the Lord, as an expression I've sometimes heard. It's not just keeping house for the Lord when we're in the church. We are approving and encouraging mediocrity sometimes when we use that type of expression. Mediocrity of effort. We're sometimes encouraging going through the motions when we talk about just keeping house for the Lord. No, the church, the congregation, is a lot more than that. It's a place where we should expect to see growth in one another and not just become an old boys club where we let each other get by with mediocrity or worse. Those who have the desire to serve the Lord and do the work will do that, but they need to be encouraged. This is the place when that boy comes into the church that he begins, if he hasn't already learned it, he begins to learn to count the cost. Here they begin to learn the price that has to be paid if you're going to serve well in the church. And the ones who are going to be the leaders tend to take upon themselves the development and the growth that they need to do. They begin to make decisions about their niche in life and what that's going to be. Here they begin to form a true estimate of what their abilities are with which God has uniquely blessed and equipped them. This, when they come into the church, this is where they begin to see where they fit in the family of God, as they are given opportunity and they either succeed or fail in what they do with that opportunity. They begin to see where they fit. They begin to decide how they can best serve. They begin to decide whether they're willing to pay the price that it takes to really grow up in Christ. Every young man in the church needs, on some kind of a level, and I don't say that this needs to be true in any formal way, but he needs to be mentored in some kind of a way. If you're a young man and you're not being mentored by an older man in the church, you're being damaged by that. It may not be that you're spending a lot of time together. It may not be that there's a lot of advice passing, but there will be in conversations little snatches of things. Chad was remembering at the table downstairs while we were eating lunch that one time he came home from work, I don't know, it was midnight or something, and I was sitting there on his driveway waiting for him, talked with him until 3 o'clock in the morning, until I figured out that he had to get up at 5 to go to work again, so I left then. But those times with Chad, I remember going over to Bill's house and others as well, those were times of mentoring for me. I don't know that those guys even knew it, but those were precious moments for me. Here were people who were farther along on the Christian road than I was. They knew things that I didn't know. I knew that they knew things that I didn't know, and I wanted to know those things. I wanted to know how things work in the church. What happens in this situation or that? And they, just by conversation, this was nothing I don't think that they had to prepare for. It's not a teaching of a class. They just were conversing with me. I was, in essence, rubbing my life up against their life and learning by that process just almost by osmosis again. That's what I'm really meaning by mentoring here. Bear in mind, not every boy has a godly father. Not every boy in the church has a father in the church or a grandfather or even any relatives in the church. And this is one reason the Lord established the church as he did, so that suddenly when we come into the family of God, we've got all kinds of fathers that we never had before. We got a bunch of grandfathers that we never would have had otherwise. We need to think of the church as God's family on that real level, not just in saying the words, but think of these young men as our real spiritual offspring, perhaps just as Paul did, talked about Timothy as his son in the faith and talked about Titus as his son in the faith. He had evidently converted them. It's what he was referring to when he used that kind of terminology. In 1 Corinthians 4:15, he says, "While you may have 10,000 instructors in Christ, you have not many fathers, for in Christ Jesus I have begotten you through the gospel." So when he talks about begetting somebody spiritually, he's talking about converting them. But whether you converted these boys or not, you can be like a father or like a grandfather to them with not necessarily a whole lot of effort on your part. There are some who perhaps are hungering for this. In the church, the future leaders are given opportunity to develop and grow, but they are given no more opportunity than any of the rest of the boys. We don't even know which ones they are yet at this early stage. Who can look at their 2-year-old boy and say, "Son, you're going to be an elder someday"? Nobody can do that. We don't know. It's not even up to him entirely or even primarily, perhaps. It's not even up to him. I used to have a lot of trouble answering this question. Are you going to be an evangelist? People used to ask me that. I don't know what the answer to that is because it wasn't up to me to make that decision. You'd usually end up muttering something like, "Well, I would like to be, but, you know, I don't know." And they would think I was hedging, but it's not hedging. It wasn't up to me whether I was going to be an evangelist or not. It couldn't be done against my will, but it could not be done only by my will. And this is true in the eldership as well, of course. But these decisions are, where the elders and deacons are concerned, these are congregational decisions that are made. And sometimes there's somebody who wants to do this and feels that they're equipped for it, but the congregation doesn't see it that way. There can be no governing of God's people without the consent of the governed. So we give opportunity to all of our boys, and we see how they respond to that opportunity. They are the pool from which our future leadership will be picked. Everybody within the local congregation should have the opportunity within the limit of his ability to do what he is willing to do. There is a third step here, and I don't know quite where to put this, so I'm going to put it right here. I'm just going to call this personal responsibility. At some point, hopefully in the home, but definitely in our early years in the church, we need to develop a real sense of personal responsibility. Because if you will not take it upon yourself to learn the Bible, if you will not take it upon yourself to do the work of the Lord, you're never going to be in a leadership role, or you should not be in a leadership role in the church. You cannot hope to take responsibility for other people's souls when you won't even take responsibility for yourself. This is a strident and important point that I cannot make too vocal. The primary responsibility for the development of a Christian leader, whether he's an evangelist, an elder, a deacon, or none of those, but still a leader in the church, the primary responsibility for the development of a Christian leader is his own. It's his own responsibility. To a great extent here, he's on his own recognizance. We can say all we want about the elders overseeing this and older members, older men helping to mentor him. That's all important. His father doing a job. I know people who are good leaders in the church who had all the odds stacked against them from day one, and yet they still came through with shining colors because of point number three. They simply took a sense of personal responsibility. I wish we could bottle that and hand it to each other to drink, that sense of personal responsibility. I'm not sure where it comes from sometimes. If he won't take it upon himself to learn the Bible, then you can't make him do it. We need elders who know the Word of God from cover to cover. I'm not talking about having it all memorized, but I am talking about knowing what each book in the Bible is about, having a general sense of what is being said in each book of the Bible. This ought to be common parlance with us if we're preparing for leadership. He's never going to be a leader unless he will do this himself. If he's not a self-starter, he's worthless in a leadership role. This is back to work habits again, primarily learned in the home, but we can unlearn and relearn at any time if we choose to. You'll never be able to get around this individual personal responsibility. Somebody compared this to panning for gold. You take a bunch of gravel and a bunch of water and you swirl it around in that pan. I don't know if you've ever done this or not, but you can imagine the process if you haven't. I did it out at Knott's Berry Farm one time as a boy. Just swirl it around in that pan, and when you come down, and all you got left are these little flecks of gold in the bottom of the pan. Or another example that's been used is the cream rising on the milk. That's a natural process that happens. You take a congregation of people, you treat them all alike, and from the very beginning they prove that they're not all alike. You give them the same instruction, you give them the same opportunities, you give them the same obligations. How do you know who the leaders are? They separate themselves. It becomes glaringly obvious within that congregation. They do when others don't do. They grow when others don't grow. They care when nobody else seems to care. They persevere when other people let up. They're faithful when others demonstrate a lack of faith. I can't explain why. I only know it's true. Give them all the same opportunity and the same encouragement, and the leaders will come to the top. The ones who love the Lord will demonstrate it in their lives. So the responsibility is his own, and that responsibility is to grow up. And what do we grow by? We grow by the Word of God, that you may grow thereby. We assimilate the Word of God. We either love it or we find a way to love it. You're not going to do this unless you love the Bible, as was said in the morning session. We've got to love the Word of God. Nobody can make you do this. You cannot make a Christian leader. You can't make an elder. You can't make an evangelist. You can't make a Christian. You can't make a teacher. If he won't study the Bible on his own, there's little hope for leadership. If he wants to know, he will find a way to know and understand and learn. Love will find a way. That's true in romance. It's true in Bible study. Love will find a way. If you've got a question you want answered about the Bible, you will find a way to answer that question to the greatest extent that it's humanly possible, if you want it bad enough. You will look it up. You will look people up. You'll do whatever it takes to find an answer to that question. If you don't care about it, then you'll forget the question, or you just won't look very far. And it is entirely up to you. Nobody else can put that desire within you. If a man does not want to know the Bible, you can teach him in class after class after class. He'll never assimilate any of it. It doesn't matter how often he comes to church and how long he sits there. We need leadership in the church, but we've got to start in the right place to secure it. And if every one of us will fully lend ourselves to the Lord's cause, I believe all of our leadership needs will be abundantly met. Last year, I think, at this study, John Morris read that poem called God Give Us Men by Josiah Holland. I want to read that again because of the pertinency of it here. God give us men. A time like this demands strong minds, great hearts, true faith, and ready hands. Men whom the lust of office does not kill. Men whom the spoils of office cannot buy. Men who possess conviction and a will. Men who have honor. Men who will not lie. Men who can stand before a demagogue and damn his treacherous flatteries without blinking. Tall men, sun-crowned, who live above the fog in public duty and in private thinking. For while the rabble with their thumb-worn creeds, their large professions and their little deeds mingle in selfish strife, lo, freedom weeps, wrong rules the land, and waiting justice sleeps. It has been my experience in the church that God has given us good spiritual leadership in the past and in the present. In many, many of our congregations. When we talk about training for the future, I think we need to try to think in terms of the process by which and through which God may be pleased to give us such men for the future. We come to a fourth step here that I'm just going to call apprenticeship. There, in recent years, I think, has been a renewed emphasis on apprenticeship in business and industry, but it's always been emphasized in the Bible. In the 16th chapter of the book of Acts, we have a son of a certain woman who believed, Timothy by name. He had an unfeigned faith that came from his grandmother and his mother into his life. We see in verse 2 of Acts 16 that he was well reported of by the brethren. So, he was the son of this woman, that's his home. He was well reported of by the brethren, that's his experience in the church. He had been in the church for some period of time. He was well reported of by them. What's that mean? It means that they had given him responsibilities to develop and grow, and that he had been taking advantage of these responsibilities to develop and grow. In the local congregation first, we do not apprentice him as a way to lay the first foundation. We do not apprentice him to teach him Genesis from Revelation. That happens here, and if it doesn't happen here, then it happens here. He learns a good deal about the Bible here because of his personal responsibility. The apprenticeship comes after that, at least as I'm viewing it. Paul doesn't pick up somebody because this boy needs to be in a halfway house. This isn't the idea here. Apprenticeship is not a halfway house. There is a sense of personal responsibility. Paul could see that in Timothy. Later of him, he said, I have no man like-minded who shall naturally care for your state. There was nobody like Timothy. Paul could see that in Timothy when Timothy was young. I don't know how young. We're not told that. But I don't have anybody like-minded, Philippians 2:20, he said of Timothy. So in the third verse then, in Acts 16 and 3, we're told, him would Paul have to go forth with him. And that's what I'm referring to as apprenticeship. And that can happen in a local congregation as well. It kind of blends in with that mentoring we were talking about a while ago. A teacher invites a young man into the classroom, and this could be a girl too, of course. We can work on that level as well. Female teacher invites a girl in to teach in her classroom. But since we're talking about men, I'm thinking masculinely here. A teacher of a class, maybe it's a teenage class or even a younger class, male teacher of that class invites a young man into that classroom to share in the teaching. Maybe he makes assignments. Next time I'd like to have you teach the class, or next time I'd like to have you present 5 minutes on this at the beginning of class. This is the process of apprenticeship. An elder begins to share his responsibilities of planning with some who care and some who can do. A deacon invites interested younger people to participate in the work of a deacon. An evangelist involves young men in his work, as Paul is doing here, taking Timothy with him. All this is done, of course, so that when we die, the Lord's work just goes right on. And people may be sad about our death, but the church isn't going to be decimated when any of us dies if we keep this on. We don't start thinking about these things when we're 80 years old. Well, I'm not going to be here forever. We need to think of future. We need to be thinking of the future all the time. in every congregation? What are things going to be like around here in 10 or 20 years? What can we do to help what's going to need to be happening in the future? When Jesus left here after 3.5 years, he left trained men behind him. Paul wrote to Timothy, "The things that thou hast heard of me amongst many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also." 2 Timothy 2, verse 2. So this process is to be ongoing all the time. We never let up on this process. It may not always seem to work out well, but we continue to work out this process, and then we let the chips fall. We do the best we can with it. Paul and Barnabas, John, they had to their minister. They took him along. He was supposed to be learning, I assume, while he was on this trip, as well as helping them with work that they needed done. They had him as their servant, and he left and went home. Didn't seem like things had worked out very well. And there will be people with ability but no stability. There will be people who have a desire but have little self-control. This process tends to weed them out along the way. As you know, John Mark came back stronger than ever later, and all was well that it ended well. But it doesn't always happen that way. We're not so much responsible for the result as we are for implementing this process, doing the training that needs to be done. And if we do this, then we will be well rewarded in many instances with the leaders that we want. If we're thinking in terms of leaders, was that a hand back there or just, Seth, was that your hand? Okay. Feel free to comment if you want as we go along, but I wanted to say this about being leaders. Most of you who are here have already picked your mates for life, and so there's nothing more to be said about the selection for you. There are a few here, at least two that I'm looking at, who have not yet picked mates. This is a crucial decision if you would like to be a leader in the church. I can still see you, Seth. And it's not too young to be thinking. You know, marriage is not for everybody, but it's for most of us. Most of us need a good woman. And it's not too young at Seth's age. Seth's 11 years old. It's not too young to be thinking in terms of what kind of a girl am I eventually going to commit my life to. In fact, I wish more of us would think of these things at a younger age. What kind of a mate will I select? It's so crucial. A woman cannot qualify you for the eldership, but she can certainly disqualify you if you're married to her. And that can be a very sad thing. So if you are in the category where you have not yet made this selection, as Benjamin Franklin said, keep your eyes wide open before marriage, half shut afterward. But before marriage, your focus is on finding the right one. After marriage, it's on being the right one. You've already found the right one. Or you've found one, and now you're committed to her for the rest of your life. So just be the right one for her, as John was well pointing out. The selection of a mate can hardly be overemphasized. So that's a crucial issue. Also, I want to revisit this sense of responsibility just for a moment. I know I talked about it and emphasized it before, but I don't know of anything more crucial. It's the way we think of ourselves. We need to think of ourselves as being the initiators in the church. We that are strong, we need to think of ourselves as being the strong. Paul says, we then that are strong. Let's think of ourselves as being the strong and being the ones who help to chart the course of a congregation for the future. We also need to say a word about pride of office, because this is a stumbling block for a great many men. Many men have the sense that if the congregation selects you and an evangelist appoints you as an elder, that this is a great honor. And yes, it is an honor. There's no denying that. It's about this much honor and about this much work. And if you go into it thinking about the honor, you're going to be overwhelmed by the work. There's not really much honor to it. We hope that the congregation will appreciate you, but whether they do or not, once you're placed in that office, you are responsible to do this work. So try to keep yourself away from any idea of the pride of office. Think of it the way the Lord taught us to think about it. Let the greatest among you be the servant of all. When you're placed in the eldership, you're not on the top, you're on the bottom. You've got the whole congregation on your shoulders, and you will feel that weight if you take that responsibility seriously. People who love to have the preeminence in the church, I hope we can keep out of the eldership. Often a congregation will sense this and will tend to screen them out when the selection process occurs. Loving to have the preeminence is a terrible thing. And you saw how it worked out when John wrote his epistle about Diotrephes. Not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. He desires the work of the overseer. He wants to see this work done. He wants to lend himself to that process. So he desires this work in that way. But he's not desiring an office of honor or to be honored by men. Another thing about being leaders is the concept of addiction. Addiction to the service of the saints. That word addiction, and we're talking about in 2 Corinthians, the last chapter of 2 Corinthians, about the 15th verse or so, that the household of Stephanas was addicted to the service of the saints. This is a real concept that an elder or a deacon, an evangelist, we all need this. This is what prompts us. This is our magnificent obsession, as it were. This is what causes people to work longer and to work harder and to think of themselves as the servants of all. As Paul put it in the 6th chapter of the Roman letter, you became the slaves of righteousness. You used to be the slaves of sin. Now you become the slaves of righteousness. You work just as hard as for righteousness as you used to work at gaining all the gusto you could in the world of sin. So being addicted to the service of the saints, this should apply to everybody who is or is going to be an officer in the body of Christ. This idea of care, which I've already placed on the board, care and concern. Paul was doing this job in his mind all the time. I believe even when he was in bed, he was thinking of this. He said one time when he was dealing with a particular situation where the Corinthian congregation was concerned and where Titus was concerned, that I had no rest in my spirit because I found not Titus, my brother. And another place in 2 Corinthians, he talked about the care of all the churches coming down upon him. We do want to find ways for our leaders to have the right amount of recreation and to be able to get away from it all so that they don't have to think about this 24/7 all of their life, yes. But I don't think it's that bad for an elder or an evangelist to lay in bed at night thinking about the problems in the church. I don't know how you avoid it, really. But I just don't think it's that bad. Some of our best solutions may come to us while we're laying there or if we get up and walk around a little bit in the middle of the night. I think it takes some of this addiction, some of this obsession, some of this care and concern. I don't know what you want to call it, but the type of thing that Paul meant when he said, "Woe is me if I preach not the gospel." This type of innate drive within him to get the job done, whether he was supported or not, wasn't the issue. It was easier if he was supported, but if he wasn't supported, he had this drive to do this work anyway. These are the kind of people we need. We are not talking necessarily about well-rounded people here. We're not talking about people who are well-adjusted, as the world uses this expression. We're talking about, in some cases, a monomaniac with a mission who will live the Christian life, be kind and polite and considerate to all who are not as obsessed as he is. Yes, he'll have a strong standard for himself and maybe a little lesser standard for other people. He'll tend to cut them some slack more than he'll cut for himself. If he can't cut other people a little slack, then he's going to have a tough time in one of these jobs. We must understand when we're in these leadership positions that not everybody in the church is addicted to the service of the saints. Not everybody in the church does care. But what we want to do is try to encourage them, try to enhance and develop them, and not ride herd on them so hard that they are discouraged. This is a very difficult thing, I'm not sure I clearly have a handle on all that, even after all these years. But I know the reason I'm saying this is I know that men in the eldership in particular who have very strong convictions about the way things ought to be, and they live their own life by those standards, hopefully. But there may be some things that are in their convictions that are not biblical, or at least not clearly biblical. He may have a strong stance on various life habits or life choices that he has come to believe are good for him and he thinks would be good for everybody. A man of very strong convictions in the eldership needs to be very sure that he is not imposing any more of his convictions on the church than he can clearly sustain from the Bible and clearly show from the Bible that that's the way it needs to be. And sometimes it's easy, if you have these convictions, to read them back into the Bible and think you're getting them out of the Bible when maybe you didn't really. Maybe the Bible is not as specific in its generalities about some of these issues as you think. And we just got to be careful about what we impose on the congregation. If you have a clear conviction, Paul says in the 14th chapter of the Roman letter, that's great. Impose it on yourself in the sight of God. But him that is weak in the faith receive you, but not to doubtful disputations, not to disputes over opinions on some of these issues. So it's there's a real knack to having these strong convictions, having these well-documented opinions, and yet being able to supervise a congregation where not everybody shares all of your convictions and your opinions. Just how are you going to handle that? I've seen this make or break elderships, elders in particular, depending on how they handle that. Paul said he was concerned with the care of all the churches because he felt this so deeply. A leader in the congregation needs to be an example to the believers, but he also needs to learn to delegate. This is hard if a man is a perfectionist, but he needs to learn to delegate. Part of the leadership of the church is learning to spread this work around. Give a job to a person whom you may be afraid is going to mess it up, and then let him go ahead and mess it up, and then sort of pick him up when he falls and discuss with him what went wrong and help him to have it go better the next time. Delegation is not pretty. If you ever taught a child to eat chocolate pudding, you know that. Delegation is not pretty. It's easier in the short term to just do it all yourself than it's done the way you wanted it done, theoretically. But Jesus taught us that we must delegate. He delegated to these 12 that he selected. He delegated to others as well. And we must delegate. It's difficult for a person who has a strong sense of how things should be. Volunteerism in the church, and after all, it's a voluntary organization. Nobody's in it who did not volunteer to be. So it is a volunteer organization, and to some extent it needs to be viewed in that way. Volunteerism in many people's minds tends to mean a more relaxed approach. So we need to put that in the till and mix it up along with doing things decently and in order, in being sure that everything gets done that needs to be done. It's a tough job, really tough job, to be an elder year after year. An elder also needs to learn from day one that he goes into the eldership that a lot of the flack from the flock, a lot of the flack from the flock is not meant personally and shouldn't be taken that way. Sometimes it's just flack against authority. Be aware of this. If you're not now an elder and you become an elder, many people in the congregation are going to view you differently than they did before. Well, of course, they should view you differently. You're now in authority over them. But to some people, that means that you can no longer have the relationship with them that you did before. I have seen elders discombobulated by this more than one time. Well, here I've let you put me into the eldership, and now people act like I've changed. I haven't changed. I'm still me, they'll say. And that's true. They are still them. But the congregation or a substantial portion of it is looking at you a little differently now. They may sense a little bit of distance that was not there before. There are things we can do to try to overcome that distance. But there are some people who just have a burr under their saddle where authority is concerned, no matter what kind of authority it is. They just don't like the idea of authority. In some cases, they've never really come to terms with this in their lives. They've never faced it, but it's sort of a subconscious thing with them. And they'll take it out on an eldership the same as anybody else who's in authority. There'll always be some carping criticism or something. I think an elder needs to know from the beginning that this is not necessarily directed against him personally at all. It's just because there can be a built-in gap between authority and the followers of that authority. A lot of people in the past few years in particular, and it's in some churches of Christ that I have known of, they have tried to get away from the concept of the authority of elders. Well, you're not going to get away from it scripturally. They have never been able to get rid of that word obey in Hebrews 13. Obey those who have the rule over you. That is authority. That is a substantial authority. And this is why we need to place men in that office who can handle this authority without it going to their head, who can handle any difference that it makes in their relationships with the congregation, and who can handle this authority well while understanding that it is a delegated authority by the chief shepherd and that they've got plenty to work on still themselves. I'm going to pause here and see if anybody has any questions or comments you want to make at this time. Go ahead, Calvin.
What was your scripture that you used on the addiction?
1 Corinthians 16:15. Yes. Addicted to the service of the saints. It's not translated that way in every translation, but the 1769 King James Version translates it that way. And that is an exactly right translation as well as I'm able to find. And a very pertinent point. If you're addicted to the service of the saints, that means you can't wait to do it. This is your life. It's like somebody wanting heroin, only you want to serve somebody. And when you're that way, then you've got to control yourself to keep from doing too much. Whereas many people are just the opposite. They have to drive themselves to do enough. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I mean,
okay. Devoted, it may mean the same thing to me. It doesn't carry the same weight. Yeah, it doesn't carry the same weight at all. Devotion, consecration, those are very similar or the same as addiction. I guess I like addiction because of its connotation in our society. We think of people being addicted to something. They feel like they can't live without it. And often it's in terms of some kind of a drug. And I think that's the point Paul is making here. This particular family, their drug was to serve the church, to take care of people, to see that things went right for people. And I know people like this in the church. I think you do too. I know people who are always doing something for somebody to help them out. I take it that they are addicted to the service of the saints. And leaders in the church need to be like that, need to be this kind of person. This is the kind of person that we appoint to these offices. We don't appoint somebody to these offices and then hope they become like this. We see somebody who's like this and then we appoint them perhaps to one of these offices. Let these first be proved, as Paul said about the deacons. Was that Bobby or Dale? Go ahead, Dale.
Well, it's a shame that we make so many mistakes when we're young that we have to pay for them over, and that happens in the family and all through life pretty much. We learn as we go, and by the time we get to where we know it, we've already made all the mistakes and paid for them. But you haven't mentioned maybe you're going to about the age of the elder.
No, I don't know that I was, but that's a good one. Excuse me. The word elder itself implies the idea of being older, but it doesn't tell how old he's supposed to be. And there's nothing in the Bible that tells us per se how old an elder should be. If the Bible gave an age, then you wouldn't be asking the question. Since the Bible does not give an age, neither can I. However, there are a few hints that he ought to have some experience, for example. He's not a novice. Lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Not a novice. The word novice there, neophyte, means a new plant. He is not a recent convert. Now, how long does he need to be converted before he becomes an elder? I cannot answer that question. This is a decision that the congregation and the appointing evangelist and the man himself have to come to terms with and would have to agree on. They'd all three have to agree that he'd been a convert long enough. But he needs to have been a convert long enough that he is going to be able to fulfill the function of an elder. In our culture, that may be a little bit longer period of time ordinarily than it was in the New Testament culture in some cases. What I'm thinking of there is that passage in Acts 14 where Paul and Barnabas went up and they converted some people in the synagogue, out of the synagogues primarily. They went up and converted some people in the area of Galatia, that area. And then some time later, but not a whole lot of time later, they went back and appointed elders in those congregations. Well, how was that possible? Well, if you're converting men who were coming out of Judaism, who may have already been well-versed in the only scriptures that they had at that time, the only scriptures we had at that time, the Old Testament scriptures, maybe they had cut their teeth on the Old Testament scriptures and learned all that, and maybe they had been serving in similar capacities in the synagogues. Now they come into the church, maybe they don't need such a long time to develop because they've already been developing. In our culture, it doesn't usually work that way. Joseph, is it about this? Okay, good.
I think in Titus, where it talks about an elder needs to have faithful children.
Yes.
I think that can advocate.
Okay. Yeah. They're definitely old enough for us to see that they are trustworthy.
And then my question is, could you expound on where it says faithful children?
Okay.
The meaning of that?
Yes. The word, root word, as I understand it, for the word faith is the word pistis. I don't know how to pronounce that, but it's a Greek expression translated either as faithful or as trustworthy. And the only way we know how to translate the word is according to context. God is faithful. That means he's trustworthy. This is the expression that's used of God. When an elder has faithful children, I think not accused of riot or unruly helps us to understand what faithful means there. Faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly. I do not believe that an elder's children necessarily need to be Christians. But I don't think they should be real young children either. And just how young is too young again becomes a judgment call. But one reason I do not believe that an elder's children must necessarily be Christians is I don't think Paul would give one qualification to Titus and another qualification to Timothy. And when we compare the list of qualifications in Titus 1 and 1 Timothy 3, we have having faithful children not accused of riot or unruly, and the other having his children in subjection with all gravity. I think having his children in subjection with all gravity, not accused of riot or unruly, help explain what faithful children is. Not faithful in the sense of being faithful Christians, but he's talking about children that are trustworthy. Having children that are trustworthy, can be trusted. Otherwise, I have him telling Timothy one thing and Titus another thing. And I don't think there's any real substantial difference between those lists in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, except for the context of the place. Ephesus was a much different place than Crete was. And so there's a little difference because of the place. If one of those men had been in Las Vegas, for example, Paul might have included not addicted to gambling in his qualifications. Well, should an elder be addicted to gambling? No, but it was not explicitly needed to say that in so many words because that wasn't necessarily a big issue in those places. If Titus had been in Las Vegas, that might have been in the qualifications. So the only differences in these lists of qualifications, I think, were based on the differences between Crete and Ephesus. Therefore, he's saying the same thing to these evangelists who are going to be laying on hands to appoint men to the eldership. And if he's saying the same thing to Timothy as he is to Titus, and he doesn't tell Titus that they have to be Christians, then why would he be telling Timothy that? Nevertheless, let me go a step further with that as well. If you find a man who raised his family in the church, if you'll pardon that expression, it's not a particularly good one, but it communicates. He raised a dozen sons in the church and none of them are in the church anymore. Then we have to ask why that is. If he raised a dozen sons in the church and 11 of them are in the church and only one is not, then at some point it becomes a judgment call. And the congregation, the appointing evangelist, and the man himself has to make that determination. Is he qualified enough to be considered qualified to be appointed? So there is a judgment call there. But if a man's children were raised in the church and they're not there now, then that has to be taken into account. But I don't think that Paul is saying that an elder's children must be Christians. Did you want to comment further on that, Joseph? Okay. Blaine.
Yeah, I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
Back on the age.
Okay.
I think elders were in the Old Testament.
Yes.
And I think that same word is translated in Latin, senior.
Yes, senior.
And it has the idea of age, maturity.
Right. Right, it sure does, yeah. We first say, and this is a very interesting chain of study that I hope you all have done or will do. Start with Exodus 3:16 and trace the concept of the eldership all the way through the Old Testament. That's very instructive for the eldership in our time. There's relatively little said about the eldership in the New Testament compared to what's said in the Old Testament about the elders there. Sometimes they're called shepherds. Sometimes they're called pastors. Sometimes they're called elders, but it's all the same group of people in the Old Testament as it was in the New Testament. Six different words being used in the New Testament for this. And it's very helpful to start in Exodus 3 and follow them through. And Dwayne's exactly right. This word does mean a senior. The thing is, this word senior is elastic enough that it still allows a lot of latitude of judgment. When we talk about somebody being a senior today, he may be 17 years old. He's a senior in high school. What's that mean? It means he's more senior than the juniors, more senior than the freshmen and the sophomores. But we don't think of him as an old man. We can be a senator in our country at the age of 30, if I remember the Constitution correctly. You can be 30 years old and be elected as a senator. Well, that doesn't look very old to me. It made some of you. He's a senator, but he's quite young. And the same is true of alderman, which means older men. That's the idea behind the alderman of a town, that they would be the older men who would make decisions for the town. But in most towns, you can be an alderman and be pretty young. So there is judgment involved in this. I think the reason the Lord didn't give us an age is because this was to be cross-culturally applicable for every place and time until the Lord shouts and we rise to meet him in the air, even if that's 20,000 years from now. And it won't always be the same. You might find a congregation somewhere, maybe in some remote part of the world perhaps, or some other country where people don't live as long, where people 30 years old are regarded as the seniors of that population. And maybe the age requirement for an eldership then would be different just by virtue of the way things are different in that society. Now we have a society where people are living much longer than they used to. When I was a boy, if somebody did happen to live to be 90 years old, well, you didn't expect to see them walking around. They'd be sitting in a chair somewhere with a blanket over them, and we'd go visit them and sing songs to them and pray with them, but they were about ready to leave the earth, and nobody expected from anybody anything from anybody 90, and we knew very few people. I knew a lot of old people when I was a boy, but I didn't know very many who lived to be 90. That was almost unheard of. Now we've got 90-year-olds just all over the place, walking around, playing tennis, and it's just different. So our view of age becomes different as we go along here with this. And that's as it should be. So it's to some extent, a cultural thing. And we make our determination of what senior means based on how things are in our culture. I have never appointed an elder below the age of 36, if you want to know what I have done. I've appointed three men, 36 years of age, to the eldership. I thought each one of them was a rather exceptional man. And so I did that, but I've been hesitant, to say the least, to appoint anybody younger than 36. Why? I don't know. It's just something that I have in my mind. It's not Bible. I feel like when we pass 35, it's a little bit of change in our thinking, maybe. But that's not something that I could bind on anybody. I'm not saying I would never appoint anybody younger than that. If I was in a situation where it seemed like it should be done, then I might. Or I might wait a while until he was 36. But I would hesitate to go below that myself, just among the congregations that I work among at this time. It just, I mean, 36 looks younger every day. So that's been true in my own life. By the way, I didn't set out to say, well, I'm not going to appoint younger than 36. It's just that I did it, and then I did it again and did it again. And I think I've appointed three of those, maybe more, but I'm quite sure I've never appointed anybody younger than that. I've appointed deacons younger than that, but not elders younger than that. But I don't know that there is a magic number, because people are so different. Some people are really mature a lot sooner than other people are. And if the man seems ready, if the congregation is ready for him, then let's look at his age within that context. That's all I know to do. Otherwise, the Bible would say, the Lord did not hesitate to give us numerical numbers regarding age when he chose to. He talked about widows being the age of 60 and so forth, and here's what you do if they're over or under. So he knows how to do that if he wants to. He simply did not do it when it came to the selection of elders. In the Old Testament, we had the age of 30 being a very important age for a number of viewpoints. 40 was an important number. 50 was an important number. All you can make a case for all of us. Thou art not yet 50 years old, the Jews said to Jesus. Well, he wasn't 40 yet either. They didn't say you're not 40. They said you're not yet 50, because 50 was a time when they thought a change took place in a man's life. If he was a Levite, he retired from his work at the age of 50 and became a mentor for others and didn't have to do the back-breaking labor anymore from 50 on. So God knows how to set numbers if he needs to and wants to, but he just didn't do that when it comes to the eldership. So, yeah, Neil.
I was wondering if you might address the subject of the blameless patient and how that affects how we approach as a congregation, the men of the congregation not come forward. And I've heard several people say, well, they did this, so.
And that all needs to be taken into consideration. Blameless, Wilford Landis in teaching this used to turn that around and say less blame attaches to this person than to the normal person. And I think that's a reasonable way to think of that qualification. It does not mean sinlessly blameless, that he's never committed sin in his life or nobody would ever qualify. And the same writer says, if a man desires this office, not an angel, but a man. So we are talking about a man. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. But some sins are more egregious than others. Some have been more habitual and ongoing than others. And all of that needs to be taken into account. I do think we do need to look at a man's past when he's being considered for an office. If we can't look at his past, we don't even know him. We don't know what his name is if we don't go on the basis of memory. If you and I had no memory, we'd be sitting here in a room full of strangers. We wouldn't know each other at all. It would be a strange experience. So we remember one another from before. We do remember things that each other have done. I believe when we look at a man for an office, we go back to the point of his conversion, not before his conversion. If we went before Paul's conversion, here we got a man that's murdering us. We remember when he used to murder us. Well, yeah, I remember that, but that was before his conversion. Once a man has cast his lot with the Lord, then that's a change in his life. And when we consider him for the eldership or for any of these offices, we go back to that and we think about and evaluate what his track record has been. Now, this may not be a comfortable thing, but I don't know how else to approach this. And so many of these qualifications have to do with remembering the past. Not soon angry. Well, how do we know? Well, we remember what he has been like through the years to think about that qualification. I think we need to go back to the time of his conversion. We do look at his growth and development, and all of that needs to be taken into account. But we do remember his past. That's a part of the track record. And believe me, if he is appointed to the eldership, that track record, whatever it is, especially if there's any blotches in it, it's going to be brought up again and again. And people in the congregation will use that however they can, they feel, to their own advantage. If he has a checkered past, that'll be used against him. I've heard people say, well, if he's had these problems, won't this help him to know how to deal with other people who have these problems? That very well may be true. But when we look for an elder, we're looking for a man who has lived an exemplary life. Less blame attaches to him than to the normal run-of-the-mill guy in the church. Otherwise, I don't know what blameless means. So we need to look back at his track record. Joseph, go ahead. It's on this, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess two questions. What would be an example of someone that would disqualify in the blame category? And then for members of the congregation who maybe haven't been around this person's whole life, what should their approach
be? Well, the members of the congregation give information to the appointing evangelist based on what they themselves know. And they may want to say, if they're writing some comments to the appointing evangelist, they may want to say, I've only been with the congregation X number of years, so I don't know everything that everybody else knows, but here's how it looks to me. And the evangelist needs to take that into account when all these things are put in the hopper. It may be somebody that has moved in among us from somewhere else, and they've been with us for a number of years now, but none of us knew him before he was 40 or 50 years old, maybe. Maybe he's been with us 20 years now, but none of us knew him before he was 50, and he's being considered for an office. Well, if we didn't know him before he was 50, that may be different. That the congregation may look at that differently than if they had known him all through the years. Each case is different. But the congregation needs to act on the basis of what it knows. It can't pretend that it does not know something that it does know. And there could be, you know, when we talk about sexual sins, for example, these are deemed to be especially egregious in the Bible, and I think among us in general, they are deemed to be in that way. Issues of marriage and so forth, marriage, divorce, remarriage, etc. These are very difficult things. Those types of things may well disqualify a man. Dwayne.
Yeah, would you comment on, this has changed from the qualification back to the nature and the degree of accountability at the office. It's a pretty serious thing.
It is. They watch for your souls as they that must give an account. As I see that, that account is given on the judgment day, and that God is going to ask the elder for an account of the sheep that he was to be shepherding. By the way, that is a backdoor argument for congregational membership, because a shepherd needs to know what sheep he's accountable for and what sheep he's not accountable for. He needs to know exactly who is in the congregation and who is not. He needs to be able to tell you precisely whether a person is a member or is not. How people can handle that, they watch for your souls as they that must give an account, without believing in congregational membership, I've never been able to fully understand. So I view this as God on the Day of Judgment Day taking all of this into account as he evaluates that elder. And, of course, God is the only one who could do this in a perfect way. But that elder is going to be judged based on how he handled all of these situations where people's souls were involved. And it is an extremely serious thing. Now, a man would be crazy to take on this job if he didn't love the church and want to see her best interests served. This is a job that the Lord has instituted. He wants to see us do it if we're capable of doing it. And to me, I dare not refuse it if I can do it. What's the Lord going to ask me then on the judgment day? Why didn't you do it? So it would be better to have to give an account for trying to help than for not trying to help. It is an earth-shaking responsibility that's huge. I think this is why James A. Garfield, who had served in the presidency later on, said he had been selected as an elder in the Disciples of Christ congregation that he was a part of. And when he went to Washington, he was no longer going to be there. So he resigned his eldership and said, I'm stepping down into the presidency. Now, whether he actually said that or not, I've never been able to determine. But it makes a good story that makes a point, whether he said it or not. He could have said it, maybe should have said it. Stepping down into the presidency of the United States from having been an elder. Because it really is a lower office. The presidency is just in this world and for this world. You and I are in a kingdom that is not of this world. It is superior to this world. It's a spiritual kingdom that is universal, worldwide, around the globe. And to serve as an elder in one of the Lord's congregations is really the highest office that a man can have anywhere on earth, bar none, and needs to be viewed in that way, needs to be taken with that kind of seriousness and care. And this is why compassion is important, because if we think how serious the job is, we may want to hammer people in the congregation because I've got such a serious job, I need to make it come out a certain way. But the Lord also tells us, along with all that care and concern about how things need to be in the church, I also need to love the brethren, be gracious to them, allow for their foibles and flaws, allow for their inexperience and youth, and try to lead them along the way we do with our children. I think this is one reason that an elder needs to have shown an ability to raise children, at least to a certain point, before he can take care of the church of God. Because we need to show that we can go with the rough and tumble of raising children and still come out with a good result. And that loosens us up a bit for dealing with the church, even when we feel this fearsome responsibility. You want to say more about that?
Yeah, you know, this is one of those wee hours of the morning thing that when you're an elder, you wake up thinking about it. Because as John made a good point this morning, it's all about the heart.
Yeah.
It's about how we, and there can be people that are attending, that's members of our congregation, whose hearts are not right.
Right.
And we may not pick up on it. God, of course, knows. But, you know, I often wonder, why didn't he give the elders some of that supernatural power there?
That would have just given us more responsibility. As it is, we only have the responsibility to deal with the things that we can. And we cannot read hearts, and God knows that. He'll make all the right decisions ultimately. And we're not responsible for the salvation of everybody within the congregation. We are responsible for helping the congregation be an environment that invites growth and the taking of responsibility, so that everybody in the congregation can grow up to the greatest extent of the abilities that God has placed within them. It's the responsibility of elders to make the congregation a place of growth and development, and to as much as possible engender a good spirit within the congregation. You walk into a congregation, you can tell within a relatively short period of time what kind of spirit there is within that congregation at that particular time. If there's been difficulty and problem there, it'll be a spirit of suppression or afraid to speak out and say anything. And other times you have a spirit that's much more open than that. You can tell what the spirit of a congregation is at any given point ordinarily. And an elder has a lot to do with helping the spirit within the congregation be pretty good most of the time. Won't always be, but it's kind of like a family, like John was talking about. You can go stay in somebody's house and you can tell maybe more than you wanted to know about how things are going in that household. That's certainly true. And it's true within congregations as well. Elders have a lot to do, more than anybody else in the congregation. They have a lot to do with helping there be a good spirit, a spirit de corps, as is sometimes said. Just a good working spirit within the congregation where we can share humor, we can have fun and jocularity, but yet there be a seriousness about the Lord's work. Elders help to set that tone, primarily by example. Other questions? Yeah, Brett.
It's changing in a little different direction. We talked about all the work required of elders, and then we know that we're having a plurality of elders, pretty clear. But how might a congregation think about how many men would be part? I guess that would be the evangelist's point, but how should we think about how many men ought to serve in this position?
Usually we have the opposite problem. Where can we find enough men to fill this position? But I would say in a congregation, I wouldn't set any limit on it. If we've got a whole bunch of qualified men within that congregation, let's appoint them all and let them be the eldership of the congregation. That way their workload can be lighter for each one, theoretically. It would be, I wouldn't have a problem with a congregation having 20 elders at all. I've never had the experience of appointing that many in one congregation. We had 6 here one time, which is the most we've ever had here, I believe, in all the years of this congregation. But there can be a lot of benefit from that. So I cannot imagine a scenario where I would say to a congregation, well, you've already got enough elders, you don't need any more. I'd say, let's appoint them. What Moses say? I would all God's servants were prophets. And I think the average elder would say that too. You're not going to have too many if they're the right guys. Now, if they're going to be contentious and factional, then no, you don't want them in there. But you don't want a factional man in there even if there's only 2. So that's not an issue of how many. If they're the right men and they're ready, let's place them in the office. Let them work with those who have been in for a longer time and learn from them before the older pass on. Excellent question. Yeah, I would like to see that kind of a problem present itself. Do we have too many elders in this congregation? Usually we're in the later years we've been having a problem with being able to find any elders for many congregations. Good question. You want to say more about that, Brett? Okay. Bill, Bob, sorry.
Okay. Can you think of some examples in your past experiences where there were men that were qualified but were not chosen by the congregation? What and why? What would you do?
That's a tricky question. Not that you intended it that way, but so many of these qualifications are you have to decide to what degree you're going to apply the qualification to a man. When the Bible says, for example, not soon angry, well, how soon? One person can look at a man and say, well, he gets angry too soon. Another person says, no, I don't think he does. So it's a difference in honest judgment on the part of those two people. So does the man meet that qualification or not? I have known of cases where people claimed that they would say, well, you know, I look down the list of qualifications and it seems like he meets them, but I'm just not comfortable with him for the eldership, and I can't really express why. Well, I tell that person, you should not recommend this man for the eldership. There's something about him that's telling you no, so go with the no. You might want to determine why, but whether you can figure out why or not, just do not recommend him. Do not recommend a man for the eldership if you do not want to see him placed in the eldership. That may seem like that would be obvious, but it's not necessarily obvious to some people. I'll say it again. Do not recommend a man for the eldership if you do not want to see him as an elder of your congregation. And if you can't figure out why, then maybe you need to just think about it some more. But there's something about the situation that's telling you that he would not be good in that role. So don't deny what your gut is telling you about that. There's got to be something there. So now, in that instance that Bob has mentioned and which I have portrayed here, if enough other people within that congregation do recommend this man as qualified and as wanting him in the eldership, then the man who says, I just don't want to see him in that role, would have to have a scriptural objection to him to have an objection heard. When we go through the time where there is a time offered for objections to a man, when his name has been placed publicly because there has been a substantial percentage of the congregation that wants to see him in the eldership, then if you want to object to that man being an elder, you'd have to come with a scriptural objection. So by then you need to figure it out whether it's scriptural or not. And if it's scriptural, go to the evangelist. If it's not, then just you don't have a leg to stand on if you don't have a scriptural objection to him being an elder. Chances are, if you have that reaction to him that you just don't want to see him as an elder, there will be other people in the congregation that feel the same way, and he won't have a great deal of support. But that's not always true. And bear in mind that there is a reason, whether you know what it is or not, there is a reason that you don't want him in the eldership. You need to think about that. And I think given enough time, you can figure out what it is. It may be a reason that you don't want to admit. This often happens. There will be something about somebody that the people in the congregation are loath to admit. And so they'll say things like, well, I think he's too young. Because that's a pretty soft objection. That's about the softest objection you can give. I think he's too young. So they'll say that instead of saying what they're really thinking sometimes. But if you don't want him in the eldership, there's some reason why. Because we all, if we want the large church to progress, we want there to be good, godly elders. You're afraid that somehow he would not be a good, godly elder. So what is it about him? What is it about his track record that's talking to you? Try to come to terms with what it is. And maybe if you do get to know him better, that objection that's in your mind may be overcome. I've seen that happen more than once. Sometimes we need to just give these things a little more time, and time can be a clarifier. I think that was true in the case of John Mark. John Mark left a bad taste in Paul's mouth. I don't think Paul was wrong when he said, we're not taking him on our next trip, any more than I think Barnabas was right. I'm not sure it was a matter of right or wrong. It was an honest difference of opinion. And the contention was so sharp between them that they had two preaching trips instead of one, which isn't bad by any means. They could do twice as much, perhaps. But later on, Paul says that John is a good man, a good helper. And John Mark evidently grew over time. So there's nothing wrong with stating a hesitation that you have, even if you can't nail it down. Maybe the appointed evangelist, through a little Q&A, can help you distill what it is that's bothering you about that person. Maybe with permission, there could be a conversation set up where something could be clarified that's happened in the past, or some kind of an attitude could be clarified. Communication is key to the process of selecting officers. There's no one thing that's any more important than that, except just trying to be scriptural. But communication is so key in the process of selecting and appointing officers in a congregation. And it's something that we need to take our time with. Joseph, you seemed like you were about to say something else, were you?
It seems like, in my experience, there seems to be a progression, and maybe it doesn't need to be others. Deacon to elder?
No, it doesn't need to be. No.
That seems to be something that's commonly practiced.
Well, I don't know if it's practiced on purpose. I think sometimes when a man might be considered too young or not have quite the qualifications for the eldership, maybe he'll be placed in the position of a deacon. That can be good or bad. Some of the best elders we've had have been deacons previously. But there's nothing about the eldership that says you have to be a deacon first. It's certainly not a stepping stone to the eldership. Many men who become deacons, probably most men who become deacons, will never become elders. And I think I could make a case that if you do not place a man who you think may be a future elder, do not place him in the role of a deacon. You're allowing him more time to learn the word and maybe raise family if he's still working on that. So you may be doing him a favor by not putting him into it. On the other hand, you may be doing him a favor by putting him in as a deacon and letting him get familiar with what that work is too. So I could come down on either side of that. To me, it's just I would leave that with the will of the congregation and with the desire of the man. I have known men who, when they thought we had plenty of deacons, they just declined the offer to be a deacon. I think with a view to possibly being an elder someday, but just feeling like they needed that extra time. So it's a very individual thing. The work of a deacon we haven't talked about very much, but it is a good and important work. Good deacons can take so much burden off the back of elders, and bad deacons make more work for elders sometimes. So we do need good men in that office, and I didn't mean to short shrift it. It's just primarily when we talk about these things, and we have such a crying need for good elders today, I've emphasized that part. But no, to be a deacon is in no sense a stepping stone into the eldership. Whether a man is or has been a deacon or not, I see as not having much of a bearing. Except if he was a deacon, how did he handle that work? That would have a bearing. But whether he's been a deacon or not has no real bearing on whether he would make a good elder, as I see it. Good question. Other questions, comments, or thoughts? We've come to the time we said we were going to quit. Usually gets a lot less interesting at quitting time. And maybe that's the way it should be. We appreciate very much you being here with us today. I hope it's been profitable for you. It seems like to me it's been a good session to bat some of these things around.